Hi, Jeff Davis here. I wanted to welcome you to the last session of Wordplay's fourth season. We'll be off the air for the next couple of months, but should be back on the air, or at least on the internet, by the end of this summer. You can always check naturespoetry.blogspot.com to find out what's afoot. That's naturespoetry, all one word, .blogspot.com. Hope your summer gardens are bountiful, the fishing's good, and your whole family's thriving in the meantime. Now enjoy our last wordplay for now, the special memorial show for Robin Blazer. And as always, thanks for listening. It's Sunday afternoon and time for another edition of Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. This week, there was another departure from this earthly plane of one of the real masters of poetry in the English-speaking North American sphere, the larger American poetry. And he was a major figure in the generation who found place in Donald Allen's 1962 anthology, The New American Poetry. Though Robin Blazer lived and worked in Vancouver, Canada, for the last four decades of his life, he himself knew that he'd always be associated with Robert Duncan and Jack Spicer, with whom he helped transform the world of the San Francisco poetry scene in the 1940s and 1950s, and with the Black Mountain College poets like Robert Greeley and Charles Olson, with whom he found common ground in a poetics that opened the poem decisively into new possibilities. Born in Idaho in 1925, he died this week at home in Vancouver, just short of his 84th birthday. Thankfully, there's a good public archive of Blazer's reading his work up on the indispensable pages of Penn Sound. No way to cover his whole long career in an hour, so I've chosen recordings that will give us a few glimpses, at least, of his progress. The first recording comes from 1965, its occasion, the Vancouver Poetry Festival that year, which brought a range of poets, not just Blazer and Duncan, but Creeley, Olson, Ginsberg, Spicer, and others, into the, until then, quiet Canadian scene. It would never recover, and Vancouver remains today a center of innovative poetry and creative collaboration in the arts. Here's Robin Blazer reading The Moth Poem from 1965.
I'm very glad that I have have a chance to read the Moth Poem again. I made so many mistakes when I read it before, changes of words and so on. We'll try this time. For HD. A literalist. The root and mirror of a plant, its shape and power, familiar iris. The light is disturbed by the boxwood. Leaves shining, rosemary green, unblossoming. The earth is too damp. The eye catches almost a tune. The moth in the piano wherein unhammered the air rings with an earlier unease of the senses disturbed by Mrs. Arpan, wife of a sailor. The literalist. The wind does not move on to another place, bends into, as in a mirror, the breaking. The moth and the piano will play on frightened wings, brush the wired interior of that machine. I said, master. Between the morning face of turn you who turn, a complete interior furniture flecked with the children of the moth, how loud you are against glass, the strings of play on this, that, now scattered. The borrower. The one loved is holding a moth, thin, metallic, dark model with a triangular crest. What's out and secret spills, the wind dries, moves on, the interior of his body, red water with white threads. The bone, a ghost of his thigh, pale blue gut holding the shit. Highway. Awake. In the dark morning, you are circled by loss of sleep. You lean forward from the balcony to see the moth dying in the window, swept by, still wing. Loose pieces of air fall cold and catch your eyelids. The words don't fit you. Your back is a mirror, your hand a bowl holding the musical moth. Supper guest. Leaning over the white linen which casts a pale light over his face, we are not deprived. The white bowl must shine behind our words. Leave us in a fire of clouds, the tin flowers, the castles which drift out of our mouths whitely in the cold air, fantômes de sentiments, magic juices on the eyelid, so it is what is met. A white moth carries its moth body trying the way into corners. The medium. It is essentially reluctance, the language a darkness, a friendship tying to the real, but it is unreal. The clarity desired, a wish for true sight, all tangling. You tried me, tried the everyday which caught me, turning the house and the wind a lovecraft. The political was not my business. I could not look without seeing the decay, the shit poured on most things by indifference, the personal power which is simply that, demanding a friend take dullness out of the world. He doesn't know his lousy emptiness. I slept in a fire. On my book bag, one dried wing of a white moth. The story is of a man who lost his way in the holy wood because the way had never been taken without at least two friends, one on each side. And I believe my dream said of the others that one of the others always led. Now left to acknowledge, he can't breathe. The darkness bled the white wing, one of the body of the moth that moved him, of the other wing. The language is bereft. Oh, friend, it was time you came this night. You were no man attached to his office as seen through a gate or handed his hat. You were as held in a vase, orange calendula and hot pink geraniums in blue glass. That tropism made you laugh. And the room, is it possible you do not exist separate from the glow when I turned the flashlight on the door? Who is there who came dragging his bag of tears and remained invisible? The whine is not in me, is not part of the moth who escapes the cold in my electric blanket. I suppose I heard the dark, and with the craft wrought against memory, it should have been of no consequence. But the bones breathe, that frame of what is contained, opposites. The sorrows sit nearby surely, cracking their paws. Once, the eye came on ladybugs home at the foot of a redwood. They swarmed in heaps. Their shells and loosened wings flew in the wind of my steps. And once, Proteus, the goldfish, jumped out of his bowl, left the color of dried orange peel, and so it is a turn of the wheel you left, a kind of music, la-dee-da, and stink in the air, held close with the invisible rose, O imaginary knowledge. Invisible pencil. One does not willingly take the honey-sweet plant. The words are lost, the holy language simultaneous with this speech, and flatteries, this participation in mirrors, turns from the streets of some minds, one follows another man who kissed his shadow. Now a moth flies overhead to the floor lamp, stops my reading the death of Virgil, form fixed and mute. One element participates in his travels more than another, watery source, as if the hometown river flowed into the room and out of the heart. Atlantis draws back from the shine on the water. The crumbling pieces flow unattached. The cement patches, the fit of the dark streets around the towers, the wet touches, springs a trap in personal history. Interior, riotous. Smokers of poetry bathe among the ruins, slip off the rocks. Green and waking with weeds of the sea, the technical movement is made by the water harp in moth time. The waves lift the bunched up newspaper full of foam. Then, looking up, I see it run back, defecate to a pure transparency, the castle, the life of cliffs. Atlantis, the light of it, as he felt himself perish, the riotous moth, back and forth. There is a spilled glass of water, an ocean spreading on the table. Under the shine on the water, the pieces flow, unattached. It will be that horseplay the moth takes for milk. The fit of the rivers around the book, ashtrays, yellow apple, and pomegranate, here, the web falls thick, sticky. Holding the forehead, the apparent violence bathed in, a key to this privacy. He leaned over his poem, a piece of blood fell out of his head, dazzling. Clock sound, the riotous moth, happiness, and this habit of light. The sad soul wanders about a spirit like an image. This image enters the ghostly sentiment. My dear blank, we end with you circling your garden, allowing the officials to lead you in, trivial and cheap at gumps. The worthless mention of Snellgrove, Pomeroy hack divided. Phony Last Supper, Demodé drips on the California landscape, fake spooks in the upper right-hand corner of the orange machine, brief agony for the dining room wall at a price. You coming to ignore this language, which is colored, takes in slime, is some center where one is helpless even to oneself. Flowers of the mouth is smoke, alive only in the car lights, is stationary, considered as paint full of secrets, flows, still on the wall like a moth, until it is pushed, then separating with an outward stammer, officially immortal, to feed itself, the final thing, somebody else's idea. Paradise Quotations. The stairs did not creak, but the snow did. I fixed the telescope, and looking through, I saw a stag. On the way back, I saw the traces of blood, but no longer believed in their existence. First, in translucent lymph with cobweb threads, the brain's fine floating tissue swells and spreads. The marble hand, probably from its contact with the uncharmed harp, had strength to relax its hold and yield the harp to me. Nerve after nerve, the glistening spine descends, the red heart dances, the aorta bends. The white rose of eddy foam, where the stream ran into a scooped or scalloped hollow of the rock in its channel. This shape, an exact white rose, was forever overpowered by the stream rushing down in upon it, and still obstinate in resurrection, it spread up into the scallop, by fits and starts, blossoming in a moment into a full flower. Through each new gland the purple current glides, new veins meandering drink the refluent tides. For here would be the moonbeams on the ice glittering through a warrior's breastplate. Whenever a breeze went by, it swept the old men's heads, the women's beauty, and all the unreal throng into one indistinguishable cloud, ever anxious crowd. Edge over edge extends the hardening scale, and sheathes his slimy skin in silver mail. It. A white shadow there on the glass, the white t-shirt. Turns that are no longer an endless meaning, leans forward to the shaping, to find it, a flutter of the darkness, but it ducks back. From the open slit of the window, a cinnamon moth enters, and amorous the lamp takes it. Came from the back garden, planted with pale flowers that might show in the dark. It mocked, tripped, then toted its image, having no past, unprepared. The moth kiss has two languages. the one everyday, dusty, habitual, and part delight, the other an unexpended myth washes against the glass to be abstract, untied by the friendship the moment calls. Salut. You, priest, must know why you strike, tearing, teasing in that silly personality. If you fell, it is the rain falling down the hanging pot of ivy, each leaf alight, the grass of my eyes holding to a point, the dew, the spring. The piano, it was a gift, a promise of a debt of music. It was a moth under the strings, frantic to escape, played. Wings, eyed like an owl, came to the lamp. The cold has come, the moths have gone. White, gray, cinnamon, and one rested in the sun. Wine, purple wings, yellow-edged, tacked with the wind's changes, careened, then taking flight, hid in the fig tree. The circles, the moon, the stars, the plants, and below, under the earth, the sun, between the earth and the moon, a tone, beyond that, the lyre. Asleep, the four oval paintings, stories alive, the artist of the moth, his foot upon the lion's paw of the table. There is no storm in the glass, only the white edge of a sleeve, the form, nothing beyond that eye. Further asleep, there are petunias, white, red, rose, and night, zinnias, red, violet, orange, roses, silver and yellow, nasturtiums yellow, pansies blue, hollyhocks, pastel and waxy, violets, lilac, sumac, castor bean flowers, flags, purple, white, brown. What is the day? What is the charm? She, her madness, yours, musical poplars, the mind nearly destroyed by the presences, the fine points which have no beginning. Restless jewels. She is from the light on the rails, a light running miles to a point. She is in the house, an old railroad coach placed on foundations by the rail bed, among goldenrod and hop vines. She stands in the middle of the room with arms outstretched to protect the bat, which caught brown and velvet, she puts to her breast against the yellow apron. This flower, which is no flower, this new land, the day filled with invisible princes, Dr. Doolittle, the moon, the flow of rain lighting the ivy. There is no meaning here. There is all meaning here. Fran and Stan laughing, the blue glass is $9. The Husan, Isadora Duncan, looking more like Rodin's Balzac, is $350. There is nothing here but an intense interior monologue with moments of color, forms flowing toward beloved plants. The cost has been high. When all the world is loved by the daimon of mediocrity, you, priest, must know why you strike. May I ask for my own encore? Just a point that sometimes poems don't leave you alone for quite a long while. I did not want to write another moth poem, and so after several poems later, I finally gave in. And there is one more moth poem which does not belong particularly with this group, but will appear in another place. It is called The Translator, a Tale. First, the pool of water. Just waking, my arms hold it. The circle of the cold morning. Last night's coffee spoon sticks to the drain board. Under it, the clear print of a brown moth made of sugar, cream, coffee with chicory, and a Mexican spoon of blue and white enamel. The ashtray is full and should be emptied before working that translation. Attis ran to the wooded pastures of the weavers of gold, the shadowy place, where as if a bee stung his brain, he took a flint knife and let the weight of his cock and balls drop from him. So, when she left, felt her limbs lose their manhood, still with fresh blood spotting the ground, she grabbed the drum with snowy hands. Beating the polished hide with soft fingers, she rose to sing to her companions. The mound of cigarette butts moves, the ashes shift, fall back on themselves like sand. Startle, out of the ashes, awakened by my burning cigarette, a brown moth noses its way, takes flight. Thank you.
You're listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5 LP FM, Asheville, North Carolina. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and today we're taking a look at the career of Robin Blazer. In 1994, Blazer sat down for a BBC studio interview and explored his concept of poetic form and the high lyric voice. Let's give a listen.
In this country, your kind of writing has often been opposed to the apparently more controlled and perhaps also more observational poetic of English writers like Philip Larkin. People associate you not always favourably with the Black Mountain School, a remote college, was it in North Carolina, that in the 50s gave a home to writers like Robert Creeley and Charles Olson, and which also provided a base for John Cage, Merce Cunningham, Robert Rauschenberg, and many other experimentalists. How did that affect your approach to writing?
Robert Duncan once put it that we made it up from whole cloth. This is before we knew anything about Black Mountain. This would be the late 40s. And we're working to find a poetic, to find a poetry. The American experience in poetry, I think, is a very interesting one, in that if you read, as we all did with great Emerson, Emerson cannot say what he wishes to say in what he understood to be poetic form. So we get the great essays. If you look at Poe, he tells us you can only can't write long poems anymore. You only write short poems. It should be about the death of a beautiful woman, and so on and so on. And then with Eureka, which he calls a poem. It's all in prose. And one watches and look at the way the forms are searching. They're really searches. They're records of search rather than formalities. Pound, on the other hand, proposed something that, for me, personally, is extremely important. One of the earliest poets of my life is, don't let prose have it all. Let's take some of that back into poetry. Well, what we've come to is the problem about what's the lyric voice. The lyric voice, which would be the way in which one usually understands poetry, that it is lyric, that it rhymes, that it's this, that it's that. The effort of so much of 20th century verse has been to relocate the high lyric voice.
And partly that's been about greatly expanding its ambition, so that rather than being about the cavalcanti, the moment of love, or the moment of recognition, or the observation of the flower, or the song, we're talking about the lyric voice being able to handle things like economics, in Pound's case.
In Pound's case, for example.
Now, a few years ago, Jonathan Rayburn wrote a piece in the London Review of Books. You may or may not have seen it, but his argument, crudely put, was that the American line is terrible. He reviewed a few books of poems by not particularly good poets and said, more or less, this is what happens if you follow Olson. You end up with no form, no discipline, no perception. You end up just spewing on the page.
I know the argument well. There's an American version of it. It's very clear. I will not dismiss Larkin. I'm going to keep that there as part of our story. And the person who writes an essay who says you wind up with no form had better be prepared to put up for me what it, and I mean with examples, what he means by form. Does a poem by Allen Ginsberg have form?
I think to these people the answer is no.
See, form mustn't be given up to the other side.
I'm afraid we have somebody in this country, a man called Auberon Waugh, who has a magazine called The Literary Review, which gives an award to poems that rhyme. I mean, we're talking about a fairly primitive polemical anti-modernism, and it's a bit of a joke as well, which is the way that way of thinking always operates and presents itself. But there is a group of people who certainly believe that poetry should be decorative, it should be carefully wrought, and it should bear some palpable resemblance to a 17th century sonnet.
I was just thinking, 17th century sonnets, I would love to write one, because these are the greatest pleasures, and the difference isn't with rhyme. The difference isn't even with the formal line. The difference is, I suppose if you thought of translation, that would give us an example. Those who believe that in translation, you are able to take, say, a rather formal French poet, and if you copy the line somewhat, substitute the rhymes, so you get a totally different meaning, that you somehow have copied the form. Now, this isn't true of form for the 17th century or any other century, whatever. It simply isn't the way it works. A substitute is a substitute. And one may be a connoisseur of substitutes, or you may become, with the great translators, a connoisseur of a relationship to the original text. And that is what you're after. It is not form as something given, patterned, inherited, but a relationship to the way in which the syntax works, the lines work, the music works. And if you compare the poetic problem with contemporary music, isn't contemporary music in somewhat the same difficulty? I've been into music stores where they said, no, if people won't listen to that, I'm not going to carry it. They're talking about somebody like Boulez, a man whose composition is complex as it is as much interested in beauty as anything I know in music. If I turn to John Cage, I'm going to have to talk about something else. Does John Cage lack form? You see, don't trust the bastards, that's my view. Don't give them the word form, and don't trust them when they say, you ain't got any.
There's an issue that comes up repeatedly with writing which incorporates difficulty. I mean, you're invoking traditions, philosophical concepts all scattered here and there. Repeatedly one hears the word elitism used in this context.
Mm-hmm. Those are condescensions, not only to me, but they are condescensions to the public. I think it's an infuriating thing to so limit our sense of what is public pleasure, public knowledge, to the least common denominator, which is always a generalization, the particular's goal. I think, given different circumstances, that a very broad range of art can be understood by a very large public if they were given the opportunity. Two lies about our cultural condition got involved here. One, consumerism always proposes that you have an object to buy. Whether or not it be a person that you buy to take home for the big screw, or it be, you know, a gorgeous object or a piece of junk in plastic, in hideous orange, say, since they never seem to be able to do good oranges in plastic. Commercialism lies in that event because it always proposes that everything is an object. And then the second thing that is the big lie, the other one is that there's this vast abyss between high art and popular art. There is no such thing. There never has been. The popular art and high art have gone through the entire history of human consciousness. We have always belonged together. We twine like rose briars, poking one another with thorns over and over again, and we belong there always. Part of my heart is a popular heart. I can remember a conversation with Charles Olson when we were sitting there agreeing that we'd love to write popular songs. And I think we meant something as straightforward as Oh My Aching Heart, you know, something like that. The whole notion of that abyss is to constantly insist upon the commercialization of the popular. It never then is interested in the relationship that belongs to whatever we mean by high thought. We've used the term high lyric voice, but surely one is not going to pretend that the popular art in some way is not in relation to the very best philosophical thought as well. I don't know whether you've heard the Kronos Quartet. If you listened over here, I think they've been here recently. What did they do for encore?
The new Purple Haze.
Yes.
Jimi Hendrix on a string. On a
Jimi Hendrix, of course, that's a favorite, happens to be a favorite. So, I mean, we've hit on one of my great favorites, musically and otherwise. That's a stunning moment, and you've been through some of the most difficult of contemporary music, and then suddenly, I must have been the oldest person in the audience, and all this wonderful, youthful group listening to this music that they claim no one's listening to. This is, of course, the lie. And then I've never forgotten the way that audience, as soon as Purple Haze began, you heard a kind of almost everybody could hum it if you could. It was a stunning moment, a kind of revelation that we belong together in some sense. And the big lie that it is there. The public space is being taken over for reasons that I'm not sure I can explain, but I know it's taken over and it's telling tales that are not true.
So hybridity and interconnection is where it's going to be?
I think relation. So that relational, that when you watch for the way relation works inside those who leave a record of the thought.
Robin Blazer, poet and relationist.
You're listening to Wordplay on WPBM 103.5, Asheville, North Carolina. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. There's so much poetry available in Blazer's own voice that it seems a shame to omit so much. But we've only got an hour, so perhaps we'll do another show down the road to explore the poems from his collections, Syntax, Pell Mell, and The Image Nations. There's a great 1987 reading at Penn Sound from Buffalo that I'd especially like to play. Or you can download it and play it for yourself. What a concept. I did want to include, though, the late work that he undertook on Dante as part of his Great Companion series. It's an extended meditation on Dante's Divina Commedia, as it revealed itself to Blazer through years of experience with it. This is part of a 2004 reading in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Now, I'd sort of like to open with the Dante poem, because this is a series that incomplete are called Great Companions, and Dante is the first one. Dante, and this is just a little piece of it because it's too long. You'd all go to sleep on me or something. But that's from some other time. This one. So it's Great Companion, Dante Alighieri, the first of the Great Companions. The speech born in one's own house is that which we acquire without rule. That's from the De Vulgari Eloquentia. Quote, the language for which we have no words, which doesn't pretend, like grammatical language, to be there before being, but is alone and first in mind, is our language. That is the language of poetry. Giorgio Agamben, from the book Ideas of Prose. Quote, face to face, but without seeing each other from now on, the gods and men are abandoned to their writing. This abandonment is the sign given to us for our history yet to come. It has only just begun. My God, we are only beginning to write. Jean-Luc Nancy, from the Inoperative Community book. So I just read you the beginning of the poem and then turn to something else. Entering the territory, map is not territory. The boy looked up from the book he held in his lap, startled that it seemed the size of half of himself. It was so large compared to Emerson, Poe, Hawthorne, Melville, Dickinson, Longfellow around the house. Gustave Doré's Inferno of the Dark Forest, where the boy's mind multiplied the leopard, lion, and wolf in his heart. Heart and mind were then entwined. Entered the writhing trees, drew back from Geryon as if to hide, touched the page of flames that were not, rain drops, swept his hand over the streaming anguish in the air, felt the chill black of the ice around winged Lucifer, who chewed on something with two legs that he didn't want to imagine. In bed at night, after saying, please,
If I die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take, which was very hard to think about. He returned before he slept to Doré's imagery, under the covers with a flashlight, and nearly always forgot the two small figures high on the rocky promontory who looked up at the stars. Territory is not a map. There, going from inside out and outside in, he could not think how ancient he was, where the phenomena of consciousness are the phenomena of religion. This is the boy of the house in Idaho, a rail car painted Union Pacific yellow by the railway tracks, goldenrod garden of wan stems. Grandmother, Sophia Nichols, whose telegraphic mind knew the distances, in the sagebrush desert during the Great Depression, entangled with Dante before and after he learned to read. The innocence of walking there is forgotten. That means, I said, somewhat amused, that we would have to eat of the tree of knowledge a second time to fall back into the state of innocence. Of course, he answered, and that is the final chapter in the history of the world. Those last lines are from Christ. I address Dante, who is our contemporary, like us speaking out of human violence, who is implicit in our use of our mother language, who is initial and continuously implicated in the courage of poetry, whose art records an attachment to the latter, and that to the letter, whose art records an attachment to the letter that lay at the mysterious origin of poetry, the dazzlement, who is concealed in the depth of our culture like a blind spot, whose journey in poetry reverses the metaphysics of a transparent language, whose daring in the realms of the sacred proposes il poema sacro, a sacred poem, propositions of the mind in that shattered, scattered territory, of whom the story is told that at the moment he began the comedy, all the rhymes of the world presented themselves and asked to be included. Of whom Mandelstam, studying Italian in order to read him, writes, quote, "When I began to study Italian and barely familiarized myself with its phonetics and prosody, I suddenly understood that the center of gravity of my speech efforts had been moved closer to my lips, to the outer parts of my mouth. The tip of the tongue suddenly turned out to have the seat of honor. The sound rushed toward the locking of teeth, and something else that struck me was the infantile aspect of Italian phonetics, its beautiful childlike quality, its closeness to infant babbling, to some kind of eternal dadism. Would you like to become acquainted with the Dictionary of Italian Rhymes? Take the entire Italian dictionary and leaf through it as you will. Here every word rhymes. Every word begs to enter into concordanza. The abundance of marriageable endings is fantastic." End quote. The astonishment that is Dante, of whom Yeats wrote in his 1914 poem, Ego Dominus Tuus, "The chief imagination of Christendom, Dante Alighieri so utterly found himself that he has made that hollow face of his more plain to the mind's eye than any face but that of Christ." Well, when I used that passage in one of my courses in my university experience, no one in the class even knew that image, the hollow face that is more plain to mind's eye than any face but that of Christ. But it is not the self that made this face so plain to our mind's eye after him, and certainly not his arguments for church and empire, but more likely the colors he gave to language. First in his room, una nebula di colore di fuoco, then within the color of fire, a figure spoke in the high language of divinity, ego dominus tuus, eros and nakedness that overwhelm. He thought he saw una cosa, la quale ardesa tutta, the voice that said, vide cor tuum. He had not recognized his heart in flames where it was eaten. This discovery of Beatrice in the shaping of the world, the colors of this event and language fly in the flag of Italy. The face moves among the beautiful letters, never still in the alpha omega, the A through Z of our vernacular tongues, born in the house of the heart's mind, that is the heart's mind, purposed to make it known to many that they might flame in their alphabets, saluting all the fideli d'amore, that they might answer, Dante, drawing upon the Provençal experience of the reason of poems, brings us to amor. Giorgio Gomondin tells us, amors, quote, amors is the name of the troubadour, is the name the troubadours gave to the experience of the advent of the poetic word. It is difficult to understand the sense in which poets understood love, as long as we obstinately construe it according to a secular misunderstanding in a purely biographical context. For the troubadours, it is not a question of psychological or biographical events that are successively expressed in words, but rather of the attempt to live the topos itself, the event of language, as a fundamental, amorous, and poetic experience. The loved experience is found in the poetics of unmapped territory. Thus, the new life is the possibility larger than and other than the mere expression of the sentiments of subjective reality or of the self, which is as much a lifetime creation as is the poesis of the traditional soul. This event of our vernacular speech, not to be confused with the language as an object of knowledge constructed by philosophers and linguists, but a part of language, a mode of language use that is a discourse with the heart of actual social interaction and practice. Witness Sordello Genosa, mourning Cervan cats. And, quote, and so mortal is the harm to the virtues that I have no suspicion that it will ever be undone except in this wise, that they take his heart out and have it eaten by barons who lived unhearted. Then they would have hearts worth something. It's a message for today. Love's reasoning, reasoning, which Dante tells us it would be shame not to explain, enters into the discourses of the territory called world. The poetic is the language of the mapless. Dante's gift is continuously, I owe so much to Dante that that's what this poem is about. It's that debt, I'm trying to pay something back. Dante's gift is continuously contemporary in the shape he gave his poems discoursing. Out of the advent of language, one's life in language, as if life were the home of it, where the intimacy of sound discloses the amours of othernesses. In La Vita Nuova, the interplay of love and reason, poem and prose, Dante and Beatrice, friends and beloved ladies open into a territory even beyond the whitest of circling spheres, where the comedy entangles the amorous with the discoursing of myth, cosmology, philosophy, theology, history, economics, and current issues, even as Beatrice's colors, white, crimson, and green, circle my early morning coffee cup while I write. This is the polyphony of the comedy, the ever-changing polyphony of amorous thought. The gift of amorous and poetic experience so entangled the face haunting the curious laughter of the syllables that we might speak an ethics out of this mapless century of ourselves, at home, so to speak, in the unredeemable and irreparable, transmigrators of humanism, of religions, of absolutes, of ignorant hierarchies. When the sublime collapses upon us, as it did upon Dante, we are inside the condition of it, marking our footsteps among its uncanny pieces, holding on to the love of our ordinary lives, hearted or unhearted. Dante, the Tuscan Homer, as Vico called him, is exemplar of the necessary poesis in a vast territory, not exactly human, even as we take up the task of our ongoing departure from the totality he confronted. In The Difficult Matter of God in the Streets, Facultas de Sensus Averno, it is easy today to descend to Avernus, as the Sibyl tells us in the voices of Posillipo. There the door of Dis is open 24 hours a day, like the doors of the current return to religion, whose concern is with the definition of abomination and exclusion. In La Vita Nuova, Dante proposes that love, which is meaning, which impels speech. The Inferno does not come to rest in those brutalities of God's judgment. It is there that speech is fixed once and for all. Words stop dead in the depths of a bloody and frozen silence. The entire human body is devoured in agonizing contrast to the love that eats the flaming heart. Philippe Solaire, in his brilliant contemporary reading of Dante, notices that self-interest, the closed self, is a fundamental characteristic of the damned, which has consequences. Language turns upon and possesses he who believed he possessed it, but in fact was only one of its signs. The reader who stops there in the drama of closed meaning will lose Dante, including the Dante who haunts our discordant departure from Christendom. The Inferno fascinates with its imagination of the condition of irredeemable loss, the lost good of the intellect. That's Dante's phrase, the good of the intellect. Here I've made it the lost good of the intellect. We rebel at the theological imprisonment and abandonment, and suspect that Dante now and again does so too. In this ice house of language words, we think, must thaw. We are perhaps closer to rebellious Rabelais than we know when Pantagruel hears thawed out words. Do you know this passage? Well, I don't care if you do. I'm going to read it anyway. This is from Rabelais, beloved Rabelais. Okay, this is it. He hears thawed out words. He threw on the deck in front of us hands full of frozen words, which might have been sugared almonds, like so many pearls of different colors. We saw bright red words, green words, blue words, black words, golden words, and after they had been warmed for a bit between our hands, they melted like snow, and we actually heard them, but without understanding a word, for they were in a barbarous language. Panurge asked Pantagruel to give him more. Pantagruel observed that giving words was like making love. Then sell me some, said Panurge. Selling words, said Pantagruel, is more like what lawyers do. I prefer to sell you silence and make you pay more for it. But still, he threw three or four hands full on the deck, and we could see sharp words, bloody words, which, according to the pilot, sometimes went to the place where they'd been spoken, only to find the throat that uttered them had been slit open. Horrible words, and many others unpleasant to see. And when they melted, he heard hee, on and on and on. and God knows what. Così gridai con la faccia levata. Then I cried with lifted face from among the sodomites. Inferno facing Dante's theology. No, no, you get a bit more here. Inferno facing Dante's theology, even out of a Roman Catholic childhood, of the immutable and unchanging, recognizing that it is the vocabulary of his cosmology of creation and continuation in the body of thought. This entanglement of language and death, mortality is speechlessness, repetitious or masquerading in our vocabulary of such territory. I walk into a crisis of where hell is, out of this cosmology, gone in the teeth among 20th century constitutions and religious pretensions. Yes, to be clean of these hell obsessions. In another world, as Pound said, discovering hell on the surface of the earth, where, as in Dante, the present might be found. This sense of exit and departure, from the first canto to the last, the poet's path was the path of the living man, at stake in the poesis, finding the life of form in so vast a territory. Practices of the self and of freedom within these games of truth, turning round and round in, say, your marvelous kitchen, to impart relish. I read this great, vulnerable poem, materiality of language, materiality of form, materiality of men's and women's bodies envisioning as they were my own, thus to unravel the Western paradigm of one soul truth that cannot find a place, the place of its totality, founded on sacrifice, there or here. Our immortalities cannot help with this. Churches, states, even atheisms are given to the personification of totality, exchanging bed linens. You can vote for a water glass of democracy in the side table. They never apologize for time misspent, not even that the theories of themselves, now in a great gain, they rehabilitate some lives. I was talking to Galileo. I do this often, you know. I was talking to Galileo the other day about his rehabilitation. He was disdainful. We wondered who or what is speaking in such ethics of thought. Certainly not time regained, let alone eternalized. We were standing there in Rome, in the Campo dei Fiori, at the foot of Giordano Bruno's monument. He jumped right off the pedestal and said, "Listen, kid, it's better to burn." "Hell," I said, astonished. "I'm 72. We three then walked along talking about Bruno's dialogues and sonnets dedicated to Philip Sidney, the Gli Eroici Fiori, and of Plato's curious blending of the words Eros and Heros. The name Heros is only a light alteration of Eros, from whom the heroes sprang, of what it was like to write of heroic frenzies. In Canto 10 of the Inferno, we come upon the open tombs of those who questioned immortality. Epicurus, who argued that happiness is the chief good, and all his followers. The last great emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, the title lasted until 1806, Frederick II died 1250, of whom it is said that he had a man imprisoned in a sealed wine vat and left him to perish under watch to prove that the soul died with the body, if it could not escape. And among them, Guido Cavalcanti's father and father-in-law, so condemned while Guido was still alive, neither of whom had so experimented with human destiny. Only Florentines, in the midst of religious and political strife, who questioned immortality, the crown of such totality, where in modern terms a fortune teller paradises. I think of the friendship and estrangement of Dante and Guido, whom Dante names the first among my friends in the new life, of whom in hell he sends the message to his father that he is still living, who is recalled in the purgatorio for the glow of Hippasus' poems. Guido forete tu e lapo ed io fossimo pressi per incantamento. In Shelley's beautiful sonnet, which translates it, Guido, I would that lapo thou and I, led by some strong enchantment, might ascend a magic boat. In Robert Duncan's version from Among the Sodomites, we get this, quote, Robin, if it would be a great thing if you, me, and Jack Spicer, pardon me, I'm always rather moved by this, Robin, it would be a great thing if you, me, and Jack Spicer were taken up in sorcery with our mortal heads so turned that life dimmed in the light of that fairy ship. Then I turn to quote Robert Musil, there's an ancient prejudice to the effect that one is born and dies a human being. I think I could stop.
And that's Wordplay for this week. We've been celebrating today the work of Robin Blazer, who died this week at age 83. Tune in next week for more poetry on the airwaves and in the Ethernet. For more information about today's show, check out naturespoetry.blogspot.com. Have a great week.